Lister has first to make direct personal contact with the astronaut, and if something appears to be wrong with him, then diver Dixon will fire a red smoke bomb, which will summon helicopter number 3, in which is riding Army Captain Jerry Strong, one of the two men Mercury medical team standing by here on the Randolph. We're waiting and ready to go, and Colonel Glenn is going to get a very big welcome from the crew of the Randolph indeed. This is Bill Downs aboard the Randolph, 1,000 miles southeast of Canaveral.
And it looks as if the crew of the Randolph will be able to make good on their slogan, which they coined in advance, Randu can do. And it looks as if Randu will do. Well, right now, Colonel Glenn ought to be in the jurisdiction of the control center at Kauai Island in the Hawaiian Island group. And he's been on the way now for 4 hours and 25 minutes. We'll get the very latest as we switch once again to Mercury Control and Shorty Powers.
This is Mercury Control. The Mercury tracking station on Canton Island acquired the Friendship 7 spacecraft at 2.03 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The tracking station on Hawaii contacted the Friendship 7 spacecraft at 2.10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As we proceeded around from Australia toward Hawaii, we detected an indication of a problem with the heat shield deployment switch. A check was made over Hawaii, which confirmed that the system was operating properly and that the signal apparently was erroneous. He is also completing now his retrofiring checklist. And this is a process by which he makes sure that all of his onboard equipment is secured, that he has checked out his attitude control system, that he is in good condition and preparing to fire those retro rockets to begin that long landing flight toward the Atlantic. This is Mercury Control.
Well, that was Colonel Powers giving us the very latest good news on Colonel Glenn as Colonel Glenn travels eastward across the Pacific Ocean, heading for the west coast of North America and the moment when the retro rockets will be fired. We'll be talking more about those retro rockets in a moment. Right now, we're going to pause briefly for a word from Rambler and Ed Herlihy.
For Rambler, the success story continues. Rambler sales for January show another impressive gain over last January's figures. With record sales already established for October, November, and December, the 62 Rambler is the most successful new car in Rambler history. Early this month, the 2 millionth Rambler rolled off the line at Rambler's Kenosha, Wisconsin plant, putting Rambler ahead of all other compact car makes in total production. As a result of record-breaking sales, your Rambler dealer is prepared to offer substantial dollar savings on any new Rambler you buy. This coming weekend, your Rambler dealer will be featuring a weekend special deal on new Rambler sedans, wagons, convertibles, sixes, and V8s. Come see the successful new Rambler. 102 ways new and better for 1962. Take advantage of important savings made possible by Rambler's sales success. Ask your Rambler dealer about his weekend special deal.
Once again, here's Dallas Townsend at Cape Canaveral.
And here at Cape Canaveral, we're waiting for the moment that Colonel Glenn, aboard his spacecraft, will report that the retro rockets have fired. The retro rockets are estimated to be fired at 2:22.19 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That is 19 seconds past 2:22 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, about 6 minutes from now. Well, we're talking now with CBS News correspondent Charles Von Fremd, who's covered more of these launchings from Cape Canaveral than most people. And Chuck, of course, right now the critical thing is the retro rocket firing. If everything goes normally, the cluster of the three retro rockets on the face of that heat shield will be fired as the spacecraft approaches the west coast of North America. Now, there is a prime method of firing, that is a timer on board, but it can also be fired, I believe, by command from the ground.
That's right. They can fire on command from Guaymas or Puerto Grillo, and also the astronaut himself, John Glenn, can initiate the firing of the retro rocket. So we actually have three factors involved here, and I think this might be a good time to point out that one of the key words down here, we hear so much about A-OK and scrub and go and no-go and so forth, but another one of those words, I think, has to be redundancy.
Absolutely.
We have so many factors, built-in safety factors all the way through it, the entire flight, and this is just another example of it, that we have these three different devices by which the retros can be fired.
And so the chances are very slim that they won't fire by one way, one means or another.
That's right. And also, Pilot Glenn, of course, has shown during a greater part of this flight that he can handle the attitude problem himself, so it does look very good.
You know, Chuck, he said before he took off that he was hoping at some point or other to fly upside down. Have you heard any indication that he actually has done that?
No, and I'm sure that he'll certainly be asked that as soon as he is taken to the place where he'll rest up for a couple of days during the debriefing period.
Yes. Well, when the retros do fire, and we assume and certainly hope that they do, the craft won't be slowed down very much, actually only about 350 miles an hour, but that will be enough.
That's enough.
To
kick it out of orbit, yeah.
To kick it out of orbit and allow gravity once again to take hold.
I still can't figure out how in the world these scientists can sit down with their slide rules and figure out the precise second to command the retros to be fired out over California, off the coast of California, and know with the precision they do just exactly where it's going to land in the Atlantic Ocean. It really is a fantastic thing.
It's fantastic, but it is necessary, as we've heard earlier, because it's because he's traveling at 5 miles a second, and every second's delay in firing the retro rockets means that some ship or other probably will have to travel another 5 miles to pick him up.
That's right. If he's off more than 15 seconds on either side, it means he's going to either undershoot or overshoot the recovery zone. And those ships out at sea don't travel with the speed of Glenn's capsule.
What about the heat temperatures building up on the spacecraft as it comes back into the Earth's atmosphere? They get pretty high, I believe, up to around 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, don't they?
That's right. I once had the opportunity to observe a Redstone rocket, the capsule itself, without a man in it. This was a very small payload, of course, coming back in downrange on one of the islands downrange, Grand Turk. And it was at night, and you could see this fiery trail coming down out of the sky down toward the water. And this was of course, produced by the tremendous heat that's built up as the object tumbles back into the heavier atmosphere.
Just a note here, the helicopters have been launched from the Randolph, Chuck, and they'll be heading probably for the area, the exact area, where they expect that the craft will return to Earth. Well, those heat temperatures are a serious problem, and it's a problem on which the scientists have had to work for a long time. The problem, of course, is to bring the craft back without allowing temperatures to build up inside the craft that will be intolerable for a human to stand.
That's right. That's going to be one of the real tests, too, of the McDonnell spacecraft on this shot. Although all the telemetry information that was received at Mercury Control on the MA-4, that was the empty capsule orbit, and the MA-5, the Inishot, all the telemetry data indicated that there was not an appreciable heat buildup.
Well, Chuck, we're going to interrupt ourselves for a moment here to get some further word from Shorty Powers, and we're going to switch now, hopefully, on our stopwatch to Shorty Powers at Mercury Control. Go ahead, Colonel Powers, at Mercury Control.
This is Mercury Control. Our California station has made contact with the Friendship 7 spacecraft at 2:18 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. At 2:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the retro rocket firing sequence was initiated in the spacecraft. Retro firing attitude was assumed, and the three retro rockets have fired. They've been confirmed by the pilot and by our telemetry here in the Mercury Control Center. John Glenn's comment was it felt like he was going to send him clear back to Hawaii. The retro rockets have fired. The reentry process will be initiated shortly. This is Mercury Control.
Well, that's Colonel Powers giving us confirmation of what we'd hoped and expected momentarily. The retro rocket fire sequence has occurred successfully. It occurred at 2:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, about 2 minutes ago, so that our advance estimate of 2:22 p.m. was about 2 minutes off. It's a lucky thing that Colonel Glenn is not flying by our advance estimate. Well, now, when the time comes for the spacecraft to return to Earth, the first operation in that reentry sequence we're talking about involves the firing of the retro rockets on the blunt heat shield of the capsule. Now, what exactly does that accomplish? Well, we got this explanation a while ago from Colonel Powers.
In order to talk about retro rockets, you really have to begin at the beginning, and that is, what is an orbit? An Earth orbit is nothing more than achieving enough speed to overcome or at least balance the pull of the Earth's gravity. You can demonstrate this by putting a rock on the end of a string. You know that as long as you keep it swinging, the rock will stay out at the end. If you slow it down, the rock tends to fall toward your hand, or at least down. All we do with the retro rockets is reduce the speed by some 350 miles an hour. We have three retro rockets on the blunt face of the spacecraft, and they're fired primarily by the onboard timer. This is backed up with a radio command signal from the ground and backed up, of course, by the manual signal of the pilot. And all it really does is slow the spacecraft down by some 350 miles an hour. And when you do this, then you automatically let gravity come out and start pulling it down.
Well, that was Colonel Powers explaining about the importance of the retro rocket sequence. When the craft does begin to encounter denser atmosphere, that temperature we were talking about will mount up to about 3,000 degrees. That will occur at approximately 25 miles altitude. And at that point, the spacecraft will be moving at about 15,000 miles an hour. The craft will sustain temperature of that amount for about 2 minutes. And the problem will be to have it absorbed by the heat shield, which is made of a very special sort of plastic material and will burn off. Here again is Colonel Powers.
He's in voice communication, of course, with the recovery operation. As soon as the main parachute is out, we hear him.
Now, retro rocket firing. We have instructed John Glenn to retain his retro rocket packet at least until he gets over Texas. This is a precautionary measure to double-check on the seemingly erroneous switch location indication we had earlier. John feels he held his attitude properly during the retro rocket firing process and says that he can see the coast of California. He's now reporting cloud cover down toward Mexico. The spacecraft is now arcing down on its landing trajectory toward the Atlantic. This is Mercury Control.
Well, that was Colonel Powers reporting that the Mercury Friendship 7 spacecraft has fired the retro rockets and he is now heading toward a splashdown in the Atlantic. Colonel Glenn has been underway now for 4 hours and 36 minutes. And as Colonel Powers told us, he's been in contact with the tracking station at Guaymas, Mexico. Within a minute, he ought to be in contact with the tracking station at White Sands, New Mexico, as he careens eastward across the United States. We'll be back with our coverage of America's first orbital flight from Cape Canaveral in just a minute.
This is the CBS Radio Network.
KCBS and KCBS FM in San Francisco. Today, more people than ever before are wearing dental plates. However, thanks to the magic of modern dentistry, it's impossible to tell dentures from the real thing if the dental plates are given the right kind of care. And you can get that kind of care with Dentalin, the brushless dental plate cleanser that keeps dentures sparkling with a natural look. No brushing Dentalin is a safe, easy-to-use cleanser that's guaranteed to bring satisfaction or your money back. Here's all you do. Just soak your dentures 5 minutes a day in a gentle Dentalin solution. You'll be amazed at the results. Your dentures will look whiter, brighter, and more natural or your money back. That's Dentalin, a leader since 1931. D-E-N-A-L-A-N. At drug counters everywhere.
This is Dallas Townsend again reporting for CBS News at Cape Canaveral. And we're waiting now as the Mercury Friendship 7 spacecraft moves eastward across the United States, losing altitude now that the retro rockets have been successfully fired.
The next big thing now, it seems to me, Dallas, is the next exciting moment is going to be the opening of the drogue chute, some 21,000 feet, I believe, is above the water.
And then, of course, at 10,000 feet, the main chute. And these are the next two big hurdles that John Glenn must overcome before he's safely back to Earth.
Yes, Chuck, I think we ought to make clear that the opening of the drogue chute doesn't mean that he's out of the woods yet. The drogue chute is simply intended to put the spacecraft in the correct position when he is descending toward the ocean. And the main chute will do the job of slowing him down. Well, Colonel Glenn has certainly been a busy man during this flight, and he'll keep on being busy while the flight is ending, and it's now in its terminal stages, and even after the flight actually ends. Glenn has many things to occupy his attention, including that vital matter of assisting in his own recovery. Shorty Powers has summarized what the astronaut has to do at this point.
He's in voice communication, of course, with the recovery operation. As soon as the main parachute is out, we hear him, the recovery forces hear him. Then he has a series of checks that he has to make in the cockpit so that if we either lose the spacecraft or people get to bumping around in it afterward, we will not gamble with the change in switch locations or control locations. So he notes all of these locations down on a prepared checklist. He also, of course, on the way down under the chute, removes his helmet so that if something occurs in the landing, he's prepared to get out the hatch just as Gus Grissom did when he landed. He's kind of a busy guy about that time. He's not resting on his laurels yet.
That was Colonel Powers, and we have just now received word that initial contact has been made with the spacecraft via Cape Canaveral, Florida. Colonel Powers reported just a second ago that contact had been made with the spacecraft by the tracking station at White Sands, New Mexico. It's now moving eastward, heading toward the northwest coast of Florida. And as Colonel Powers tells us, initial contact has been made with the spacecraft by the tracking station at Cape Canaveral. Well, Chuck, you and I were talking about those two parachutes that will deploy, the drogue chute at 21,000 feet and the main chute at 10,000 feet. There is another chute on board. There is an emergency chute.
Backup chute, that's right. As a matter of fact, I think, well, we were talking about redundancy a few moments ago. You can point out again here that if the chute, if either of the chutes does not deploy, that Glenn can trigger them manually from the capsule himself.
Yes.
So the pilot has this much backup, too.
A question was raised the other day as to whether he himself was wearing a parachute, and we were informed that on this mission, the astronaut is wearing no parachute at all. It's simply a matter of depending on the main chute when it deploys at about 10,000 feet. And there will then come a sharp reduction in speed. Actually, the sharp reduction will have come before that. Between 55 miles altitude and 12 miles high, that's over a distance of about 760 miles, the velocity should go from 17,545 miles an hour to 270 miles an hour in a little over 5 minutes. And that's where Colonel Glenn will experience once again those 8 Gs. Now, here again is Colonel Powers.
Florida at this time during his reentry process. We have advised him that the weather in his landing area involves 1/10 cloud cover and 10 miles visibility. This should not present any hazard at all during the landing operation. He is now maintaining control of the spacecraft using the fly-by-wire system and the manual system as a backup. This is Mercury Control.
Now, at this particular point, those announcements from Colonel Powers and Mercury Control are going to pick up again in frequency, and so we may expect to be interrupted momentarily as Colonel Powers reports the return of John Glenn to Earth.
Dallas, that huge 65-foot radar and telemetry dish atop the Mercury Control building, just a short distance from here, is now actually tracking Glenn as he goes out past the Cape toward his recovery area. It's very interesting to notice that huge dish swing very slowly.
Yes.
From west to east.
Yes, Chuck, moving slowly around to keep in maximum contact with the spacecraft. And if our advance estimate is correct, he should be splashing in the Atlantic in about 2 minutes from now. The advance estimate was 2:34 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's now 2:32 p.m.
And we're waiting for the electric moment when we hear that the main chute has deployed and is bringing him safely back to Earth. Before that, here's a correction. The estimate is now 240. And once again, here's Colonel Powers.
Friendship 7 spacecraft is now encountering the atmosphere off the east coast of Florida. He is encountering the atmosphere. We estimate that an ionization layer involved in the reentry process is preventing us from having direct communication with him. This is Mercury Control.
That was a fast announcement from Colonel Powers. He's over the east coast of Florida, and at the moment there is no contact with John Glenn. Despite all the despite the presence of that main chute, the 63-foot main landing chute, the landing speed will be pretty fast, about 35 feet a second. And at that point, when it does land, the main chute will be jettisoned automatically, and the onboard electrical equipment will be shut down, and location aids will be activated. Oh, Chuck, those location aids are another example of redundant systems. There are several means that are used to keep track of the capsule after it returns to the atmosphere and then splashes in the water. After all, while there are a lot of Navy ships out there, they can't cover every square mile of Atlantic, and there's a lot of it. Let's hear again from Colonel Powers.
The Mercury spacecraft is in its reentry process at this time. We have an indication that receiving equipment at Grand Bahama Island is receiving beacon transmissions from the spacecraft. We are not receiving any voice communication at this time. On the basis of his present flight trajectory, we estimate that he will land within about a mile of a destroyer associated with the USS Randolph at the end of the third orbit. This is Mercury Control.
The world astronaut. Number three helicopter.
And if you can hear that cheer that's broken out, we understand that we're getting a report now from the carrier Randolph, so we'll hear from Bill Downs.
Bill Downs.
Recovery area and rescued by the helicopters, following are three other helicopters, which carry NASA technicians and the official photographers. Piloting the recovery helicopter is Major Will Nelson of Wood River, Illinois, who has been a veteran and doing capsule recovery work since the NASA project started. His co-pilot is Lieutenant Frank Berta of Fox River Grove, Illinois. They are now heading around in a circle around the ship. We have not yet seen any sign of the drogue parachute, a six-foot affair that opens up at about 40,000 feet to add stability to the slowing capsule. It is a perfect day here for this kind of an operation. The sky is unblemished. There is on the horizon just a few scattering of clouds. Otherwise, above us and in the recovery area, feeling unlimited. A wind of about 15 knots, about 16 to 18 miles an hour, is blowing. We are heading into that wind at about 15 or 20 knots and sailing eastward. On either side of us are the destroyers Nora and Stripling, about 40 miles away, in the event there is an under or overshoot. The basic plan calls for the destroyers to... The basic plan calls for the destroyers to pick up the capsule after the helicopters pick up the astronaut. We are now turning right. Captain Max Byrne has what the TV camera calls panned the carrier, or now panning the carrier slightly to the south and cruising in a more westerly direction. The three recovery helicopters are again circling the ship. All eyes are turning skyward. There has been no sign as yet of the Mercury space capsule. We understand that he should be re-entering the atmosphere. We should see the drogue chute very soon now.
It's a perfect day, as I said, for this type of operation. The sea is only about 2 foot waves. It's a beautiful blue Caribbean yachty holiday weather, and highly recommended for vacations, they told me. We'll be camping.
Let me interrupt just briefly to tell you that we are listening now to a direct report from Bill Downs aboard the carrier Randolph, which is in the third recovery area, and which very shortly now will be picking up the astronaut. He should be splashing down in about 20 seconds from now if our advanced estimate is correct. Back to Bill Downs.
Have you seen it? Should be up. We have not been able to spot this ship with the naked eye, and it should be perhaps more to the west. We are turning in that direction. The rescue copters have not yet headed for the rescue area or the splash area.
Interrupt Bill Downs' report again to tell you what Colonel Powers told us, that the actual recovery will be made by one of the destroyers, either the Noah or the Stribling. That is, one of those destroyers will pick up the Mercury spacecraft.
The destroyer Noah to head for the area which is west, which would mean that the capsule would drop someplace between the Randolph. What now? Do you have contact with the... Lieutenant, do you have contact with the capsule as yet?
They do not have contact with the capsule. He has not been spotted.
Whatever radar tracking that was. It was not a valid track, apparently. Now... The copters have been ordered to the west. It apparently has been a undershoot, if you want to call it that. In other words, the capsule did not fly over the carrier. And the USS Noah, the destroyer Noah, under the command of J.D. Exum, now is
reportedly reports to the carrier that the NOAA does have the capsule in sight and is on its way. I know that the boys at the NOAA had a sign out. They got a tape fake. And if they recover Colonel Glenn, you'll get a welcome he's never had before. The competition on this force, as you know, has been terrific, and particularly as these...
We'll break into Bill Downs' report again from the Randolph to tell you that the capsule has landed in the water and that Glenn has been told to stay in the capsule in the water until he is retrieved by helicopter. Back to Bill Downs.
The destroyer NOAA, and somebody aboard the destroyer said the other day, if necessary, they might throw ketchup bottles at the choppers. They have the honor to make this historic rescue. The NOAA would be about 20 to 30 miles straight ahead of us to the west, a little to the southwest. The ship is not in sight. It is impossible to see the capsule, and we did not see the drogue chute, nor did we see the main 63-foot capsule chute either. The reports coming into the ship are that the capsule is in sight. Is there any word, Lieutenant, of the astronaut's condition?
Not yet. The NOAA has the capsule in sight, is the only thing we've got.
The NOAA has the capsule in sight.
45 miles from the Randolph.
It is now 55 miles from the Randolph, and we will make then full steam toward that area, rendezvous with the helicopters, which would take us about what? About a half hour, I would think. Maybe an hour. In other words, this looked like a shot that was considerably short than originally planned. I'm talking to the gunnery officer here. Yes, I'm from the air right now. Still within the area, but we were in right. Seems to be a little off. The way it appears is that the Randolph is in the center of the elliptical area from the where the capsule was supposed to come down, and it has come down a little bit off the possibly of that, about 40 or 50 miles off.
What's your name, Commander?
I'll take Commander Bartlett for the Randolph.
Fine. And
how long would you say it would be before we can get to see the capsule and get Colonel Glenn back on this carrier? Well, I think it'll take about a half hour for the helos to get out there, and possibly 45 minutes. He should be back aboard here if everything is going right. Would you get information direct from the NOAA about their recovery operation and what is happening? The ship will, but we won't get it right here where we're standing. The ship will definitely be getting information from the NOAA. Right. Will you alert somebody down there on the bridge then and tell them to get this information as soon as possible? Because I know everyone wants to know the condition of Colonel Graham and his fate, because we want to talk to him later. And I'm not quite sure the President of the United States is very interested in this one, too. Tell him if anything find out, Mr. Kennedy would appreciate it. I don't know whether you could find out whatever. There's been a certain amount of confusion here. Capsule landed completely out of our sight over the horizon, where the NOAA, the destroyer NOAA, commanded by Captain J.D. Exum, is now in the process of racing the Marine helicopters to rescue the, recover the capsule and get the first look and have a first talk with Colonel John Glenn after his historic three times around the Earth in the ionosphere. As I think you know, this is it. Here's another announcement of the ship. Apparently that announcement was an order to make pickup speed, put on speed up to 21 knots, and try to get to the recovery scene as soon as possible. As far as I know, established between the ship, the helicopters, and the destroyer. I'm going to, if you'll pardon me just one moment, I'm going to step down and see if I can get onto the bridge, find out more details of what's going on.
We'll interrupt Bill Down's report from the Randolph again momentarily to tell you that there has been voice contact with Colonel Glenn, and that would appear that make it appear that everything is all right as far as the astronaut is concerned. He has come down in the Atlantic. The flight lasted just about 4 hours and 50 minutes, which was what it was projected before it got underway. He has come down in the Atlantic about 50 or 55 miles from the carrier Randolph, and helicopters should be on the way to pick him up. When the helicopters arrive over the area, scuba divers will jump from the helicopters and attach an inflatable collar around the base of the craft, thus lifting it out of the water. That inflatable collar is in the shape of a teardrop. It's about 35 feet long, and it will raise the spacecraft about 2 feet out of the water. Until they get there, the craft should be able to float satisfactorily. When the copters do arrive on the scene, the pilot can come out either the side hatch, which is the preferred method of egress, or from the neck of the craft. That's a good deal more difficult, and he can stand on the collar. Now, while we're waiting for further word from the Randolph, let's take a closer look at what's been going on out there in the Atlantic. Marine Lieutenant Colonel Richard Nickerson is director of the Helicopter Recovery Forces, and he told Charles von Fremd about the task of locating the capsule.
The job of actually locating the capsule is given to the Navy P-2V and WV squadrons, the long-range bombers, and they pick up the capsule, relay to us its location, or relay to one of the ships the location of the capsule, and then it's up to us to go and make the actual recovery. On the suborbital flights of Shepard and Grissom, both those men, you toss them a line and pull them up and then went for the capsule after that. You intend to have the same plan for Glenn's mission? That will be one of the plans that we have. We have several plans, and it will be up to the astronaut as to which means we employ. Now, actually, we go in on the other two shots. We hook fastened on to the capsule and then lowered the line to him, brought him up, and then, in Shepard's case, we brought the capsule back, and of course, everybody knows we lost the one that Grissom was in. But for the most part, this is a matter for the pilot himself to determine how he wants to return to the recovery ship, either in the capsule or by coming up into the helicopter. This is the astronaut's prerogative.
Yes. Right.
Well, that was Lieutenant Colonel Nickerson in charge of the Helicopter Recovery Forces. Once the astronaut, Colonel Glenn, does come out on the inflatable collar that will be attached around the base of the Friendship 7, he can stand on the collar, and he will then presumably get a horse collar lift from the helicopter that's hovering overhead. And then a smaller ship, a destroyer, presumably the NOAA, will come alongside, retrieve the spacecraft, and hoist it on deck. These extra precautions have been taken in order to avoid what happened at the end of Gus Grissom's suborbital flight. When he had a little trouble, he came out, the spacecraft took on water, and sank before it could be retrieved.
Actually, Dallas, on that occasion, for some reason, an explosive bolt was triggered that blew out a hatch. And that, of course, left the water in, and little Gus had to swim for his life. They never did find out what caused that problem, but they have tested the Mercury capsule several times subsequently, and they've had no problem with that particular matter.
Well, Chuck, didn't they actually put in an extra system to make sure that it
did not blow prematurely? As a matter of fact, that system was tested on both the MA-4 unmanned orbital shot and on the Enos orbital flight.
Mm-hmm. Here once again is Colonel Powers.
Into the immediate vicinity of the spacecraft, we anticipate pickup shortly. This is Mercury Control.
Well, that was Colonel Powers confirming what we just said, that the destroyer NOAA is heading for the capsule now bobbing around in the Atlantic, and pickup should be made shortly. And meanwhile, the carrier Randolph is 50 or 55 miles from the scene, and heading there probably under forced draft. Bill Downs may have been a little bit optimistic when he suggested that the carrier would get there in half an hour. Even carriers of the U.S. Navy don't travel quite that fast.
Dallas, don't you imagine that John Glenn is going to be one happy fellow when he's hoisted free and clear of that capsule and taken back to the carrier? Just think, he's been in there now for almost 8 hours.
He has indeed. I should think that he would be at least the happiest man in the United States. Well, now, Chuck, here at our CBS News headquarters at Cape Canaveral, we have word that very shortly now, in fact, almost any moment, President Kennedy will emerge from the White House and make a statement on this successful completion of the United States' first manned orbital flight. So we're simply alerting you to let you know that we'll be switching to Washington on a moment's notice. There will be no advance preparation. When the president's ready, he'll start speaking, and we'll be ready to switch to him then. Well, here we are, near the end of a great adventure, an adventure which started an atmosphere of uncertainty, a certain amount of doubt, but has ended in total triumph for the United States and for John Glenn. Now, we're going to switch back again to the carrier Randolph, which is supervising the recovery forces in the third orbit recovery area. So we'll switch to the Randolph. Bill Downs reporting.
Captain Max Burns, skipper of the Randolph, reports that the destroyer NOAA, which is now heading for Colonel Glenn's capsule, was in radio contact with the colonel as he was descending in the main parachute. However, after this radio contact, there has been no further contact in the splash after the splash in. The NOAA now is expected to arrive within the next 5 minutes at the capsule, as will the recovery helicopters from the carrier Randolph. The Randolph is expected to be in the capsule area within the next 45 to 50 minutes. However, Colonel Glenn, we do know, survived the re-entry into the atmosphere. His capsule and parachute were reported open. But we do not have any report of his condition. We don't have any report of his condition after the splash in. It looks good, and we are on the way, and I will keep you posted. This is Bill Downs aboard the carrier Randolph, 1,000 miles southeast of Cape Canaveral.
And here in Cape Canaveral, we do have a little further word on Colonel Glenn's condition. He traveled through temperatures that reached as high as 3,000 degrees on the face of the capsule, the heat shield, as it came back through the atmosphere. And Glenn's comment as he came down is reported to be, "Boy, that was a real fireball." But Glenn also reports that he felt fine. So while it may have got pretty hot inside the capsule, Glenn came through it without any difficulty. And this will be a vindication of the heat shield. This will prove that the heat shield, while it may need a little improvement, has been able to absorb the sudden raising of temperatures to 3,000 degrees during the period that the capsule is returning through the atmosphere and then is slowed down by the parachute and making its landing on the Atlantic Ocean.
It's also going to vindicate a good many reporters who repeatedly have referred to Glenn as that rugged 40-year-old Marine. He certainly proved it again today.
Hasn't he, though? Rugged and ready and able to make the kind of comment that is a quotable quote. "Boy, that was a real fireball." So it would seem right now that everything has been all right on the flight. Glenn is in the water, in the capsule. The capsule is floating. Glenn is in contact, radio contact, with the recovery forces. The destroyer NOAA is speeding to the scene, has the capsule in sight. The helicopters from the carrier Randolph are also flying to the scene, and the carrier itself will be there within 50 or 55 minutes. So there we have the orbital flight of John Glenn ending successfully on a note of total triumph for the United States. A moment that will certainly go down in history, in the history of manned space exploration. There will be other and greater flights to come, but
perhaps few that will have the emotional impact and the high excitement of this one. We're still waiting here at Cape Canaveral for word that President Kennedy is ready to make a statement, which we're sure will be on the exuberant side, because after all, this country has suffered, at least in the eyes of some of our friends overseas, in its space race with Soviet Russia. In fact, that may have been one of the reasons why this manned orbital flight was speeded up, in order to bring us at least within hailing distance of the Russians, who have sent one man for orbit around the Earth and one man for 17 orbits around the Earth. That was Gerontsov, who reported a feeling of queasiness and nausea because of weightlessness. But so far, there is no indication that Glenn experienced anything out of the way at all. He was weightless for about 4 hours and a half, or three full orbits of the Earth, each orbit lasting just about 1 hour and 29 minutes. So Glenn has come through it with flying colors. The ordeal is almost over, and now remains only the last exuberant moment, the last triumphant moment of the pickup and the delivery on the deck of the carrier.
An awful lot of people are going to want to see John Glenn, his wife and his children and his own parents, of course, and in a way the whole United States. But one man who certainly is going to want to sit down and have a long, long talk with John is a fellow named Deke Slayton, who has a similar date with an Atlas rocket and a final spacecraft. That would be in about 60 days' time if all goes well. So, as you said, this is just the first step in a long, long series of flights.
Yes, and Chuck, one of the processes that has to be gone through once Glenn is back on the carrier is something called debriefing. And we're going to hear a lot about debriefing from now on. As a matter of fact, when Glenn is brought on board the deck of the carrier, nobody is supposed to say anything more than the mere bare essentials to him. The reason is that the space agency wants to get from him, in his own words, uncolored by any kind of conversation with other people, exactly what happened. And they're going to get that debriefing. He will talk into a tape machine. He will report everything that happened to him at great length. And he will, of course, answer a very detailed and extensive series of questions. There will be an initial debriefing right after he lands on the carrier. And this whole process is something that involves being questioned exhaustively on every detail, no matter how insignificant some of those details may seem. Charles von Fremd asked Flight Surgeon William Douglas why debriefing is so important.
Well, people have a tendency to forget things rather rapidly. They particularly have a tendency to forget things which they themselves consider as possibly unimportant or things which they do not recognize the importance of. We want to get to this man as soon as possible. We have a large group of people, at least a dozen, who take turns interviewing him. These people ask him searching questions, hoping to catch these little things, the things which might seem insignificant at the time, but we want to get every bit of his memory down and recorded just as soon as we can, as I said, before he forgets it.
Did you find in the case of Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom that they did retain a surprising amount of facts, of details from their flight, more than you expected?
Knowing these men, I don't think that it was more than we expected. I think that a part of their training was in relating their experiences. They're used to this debriefing. They're used to observing and preserving in their memory details. They did this after their flights, just as they've done after nearly every training exercise that they went through before a flight.
That was Flight Surgeon Bill Douglas talking about the debriefing process, which will go on now for about 48 hours. It will begin when astronaut John Glenn is brought on board the deck of the carrier Randolph. He'll be taken below for an initial debriefing, and then after a couple of hours, he will be flown to Grand Turk Island in the lower Bahamas for about 48 hours of relaxation, during which the debriefing process will be very extensive indeed. After that, the plan is probably to have him flown to Washington for a news conference and a meeting with President Kennedy. And just incidentally, we're still waiting for that announcement that President Kennedy says he will make in the next few minutes.
Right now, the destroyer NOAA is coming right alongside the capsule. So within a matter of a very few minutes, we ought to be getting word on the pickup of John Glenn from the Friendship 7. The actual pickup, unless plans have changed considerably, will be done by helicopters flying from the deck of the Randolph. Those helicopters, one of them, will fly over the capsule, will hover overhead about 10 or 12 feet over the capsule, and then a horse collar type of lift will be lowered, and John Glenn coming out on the inflatable collar, which scuba divers will have inflated around the capsule to take it out of the water, will come out on the neck of that collar and will be lifted aboard a helicopter for transfer to the carrier Randolph. Now, it's possible that he might be lifted directly on board the destroyer NOAA. I believe that the Navy has made contingency plans for that. But the helicopters, as we already know, are on the way to the scene, and we might even see a race between a helicopter and a destroyer to find out which one will be successful in snagging the astronaut after his three-orbit tour of the world.
I imagine a good deal will depend on how the pilot himself feels. If Glenn is in fine condition and isn't too exhausted from his long ride and his G-stresses and the weightlessness and then that fireball return to Earth and the impact, if he does feel all right, I suppose he'd prefer to get right into the helicopter and go to the carrier. If, on the other hand, he should have sustained any injuries or is just plain worn out, I suppose his first desire would be to get his feet on any deck. And a destroyer would do just as well as a carrier.
And to judge from what Bill Downs has been saying, Chuck, the weather in the recovery area is so good that a destroyer probably would feel at least as solid as a carrier, or maybe not quite as solid. Well, anyway, here we are at Cape Canaveral waiting for word of the pickup, and the pickup should be accomplished momentarily. Glenn has been in the water now for, about 20 or 25 minutes. He came down, the drogue chute deployed at 21,000 feet. Bill Downs couldn't see it from his vantage point on the deck of the carrier, but it did deploy, and the main chute, the 63-foot ring sail chute, deployed at 10,000 feet. That slowed the return of the capsule so that it landed in the water at about 35 feet per second. It may have been a hard landing, but it's quite obvious from what we've heard already that the foam rubber couch on which John Glenn has been reclining during his flight around the world was able to absorb the shock successfully, and so was the plastic coating on the heat shield, which successfully withstood a peak temperature of 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That heat shield was intended to burn off, more or less. It absorbed the heat by burning, and while it may have been a fireball to John Glenn, at least it was a bearable fireball.
As we heard Bill Ruggles explain a few moments ago, the debriefing is very important. I think it should be pointed out again that this is not just a stunt, and it's not just a psychological war with the Russians to see who can pull off the greatest spectacular achievements in what might be considered the stunt line. This is a scientific endeavor, and the first step in a scientific endeavor that will eventually go to the moon.
Chuck, we have another report now from Colonel Powers. Here he is.
The spacecraft was picked up clear of the water at 1 minute after 3 and finally set down on the deck at 4 minutes after 3 this afternoon, Eastern Standard Time. John Glenn reports, "My condition is excellent." They are in the process now of opening up the spacecraft to remove John Glenn from the spacecraft. This is Mercury Control. That's NOAA.
Well, that's Colonel Powers with a slightly different report. As a matter of fact, drastically different. What happened, according to Colonel Powers, is that the spacecraft was recovered by the destroyer NOAA, picked up and set down on the deck of the NOAA, and then John Glenn emerged from the capsule. He didn't have to be lifted by helicopter, and there probably will be at least one very disappointed helicopter crew. So that's the way the recovery was actually effected. The spacecraft was lifted out of the water by the destroyer NOAA, which came alongside, and was placed on the deck of the NOAA about 2 minutes ago. Of course,
course, the happiest news of all is Glenn's own comment that his condition is excellent. Now we finally know for sure that we have our man back, safe and alive.
That's right. Yes. Back under his own power, able to step out of the Mercury spacecraft in which he had spent about 8 long, long and eventful hours, and to report that he was feeling fine. It's something that he has been saying a good many times in the last month or so, but this time we're sure that he has a fervor when he says it that he never could have felt before. Now, that report came to us from Colonel Powers, and we understand that Colonel Powers is standing by with some additional information, so we're going to switch again from our CBS News mobile headquarters here at Cape Canaveral to Mercury Control about a mile and a half away, and we'll hear once again from the voice of the astronaut spokesman, the man who speaks for Project Mercury, the Lieutenant Colonel in the United States Air Force, John Shorty Powers. Well, I'm sorry. Once again, Colonel Powers has crossed us up, at least on our stopwatch. We are waiting for further word, and I'm sure that Colonel Powers will have that word on Colonel Glenn's condition as he stepped out of the Mercury spacecraft. Just to summarize briefly, the flight ended about half an hour ago with the spacecraft coming down in the Atlantic about 50 miles from the carrier Randolph, which is the command ship in the third orbit recovery area. The Randolph is speeding to the scene. It should be there in about, 30 or 35 minutes now. The destroyer Noah, though, made the actual pickup. The destroyer came alongside and lifted the spacecraft on board the deck of the destroyer, the main deck, and Colonel Glenn stepped from the spacecraft. Now we're going to try once again to hear from Colonel Powers.
Dallas, I have a question I'd like to ask you. Just sitting in here today, this is my first experience in this kind of a working setup. How in the world do you know when to switch to Colonel Powers?
Well, Chuck, it's really very simple. The producer of this special coverage, Dan Bloom, hands me a stopwatch and points to 20 or 25 seconds on it, and he says to me, by sign language, which sometimes gets rather vociferous, switch to Colonel Powers. We're going to switch to
radio
it right
contact
now.
Contact with the USS NOAA. The spacecraft Friendship 7 is on the deck. It was set on the deck at 4 minutes after 3 Eastern Standard Time this afternoon. Astronaut John Glenn reports, my condition is excellent. He is in continuous contact with the people on the ship. This is Mercury Control.
Well, that was Colonel Powers, who was at last heard from about a minute late from Mercury Control, reporting that John Glenn says his condition is excellent. He's now on board the destroyer NOAA. And I imagine, I would just assume on the basis of what's happened before, on the basis of plans already made, that he will now be taken by helicopter from the NOAA to the deck of the carrier Randolph. Although, the way things are going right now, they may decide to have the destroyer come alongside the Randolph and have him go on board the deck by going up the ladder. This will leave the helicopters out of it entirely, and I'm sure that will make the helicopter forces even unhappier than they probably are right now.
No, very seriously, Dallas, this is a very, very big thing to the helicopters, pilots, and also to the men aboard all the recovery ships. They feel, and rightly so, that it's a great honor to have been the man or the ship that plucked one of their own from the water.
Yes, in fact, Chuck, they were making very elaborate plans to greet him in their own particular way. I believe that one of the men on board one of the helicopters was hoping to say to Glenn, welcome aboard, may we take you to our leader. And now he's probably saying to himself, oh, shucks, I won't be able to say it after all.
A moment of glory lost forever.
Here's Colonel Powers again.
Friendship 7 spacecraft is resting on the deck of the USS NOAA in the South Atlantic. Arrangements are now being made to let the astronaut crawl out the upper neck of the spacecraft onto the deck of the destroyer.
Oh, Well, that last report from Colonel Powers seems to conflict with what we've heard a few minutes earlier. We were under the impression that Colonel Glenn had emerged from the spacecraft, but now, according to that very latest from Mercury Control, it appears that he's still in it, and he'll be coming out the neck instead of the side hatch, which most of us were under the impression was the preferred method of getting out.
Yes, that caught me completely by surprise, Dallas. Like yourself, I'd assumed that the first announcement by Colonel Powers meant that Glenn was actually out of the capsule and on deck. But, again, this is possibly nitpicking because we do have reports that he has informed the recovery forces that his condition is excellent.
Yes, it would appear from what Colonel Powers says now that what they have heard from Glenn is still by voice radio. So we're waiting now to find out when and if Colonel Glenn will get out of the capsule. We assume that it'll be happening almost momentarily. Of course, he has to go through the process of unfastening himself, and that can be a rather laborious process to judge from what happened in the on the 11th deck of the Mercury of the gantry crane this morning. It took a long time to secure him inside the spacecraft. Now here's Colonel Powers again.
Astronaut John Glenn is in voice communications with the USS NOAA. He has just advised the people on board the NOAA that he will assist in removing a small pressure bulkhead so that he can fall up through the narrow upper neck of the spacecraft. This is Mercury Control.
That was just another detail from Colonel Powers. He's trying to come out the neck of the spacecraft, but I think that would involve a removal of the panel, which is directly in front of his face, so it may take a few minutes. We're trying to switch, not only we're waiting to switch to the White House for the words of President Kennedy, we're also trying to switch for reaction to Arlington, Virginia, where the Glenn family is, and to New Concord, Ohio, where Glenn's mother and father are. And as we've already heard, this is a great day for New Concord, Ohio, and of course for Arlington, Virginia. We haven't been able to establish the contact yet, but we'll be able to do it fairly soon, I'm sure. And I think it takes no clairvoyance to assume that when the spacecraft returned to the Atlantic and when it was picked up by the destroyer NOAA, a great cheer must have gone up in both cities, where Colonel Glenn is a familiar figure indeed. He grew up in New Concord, Ohio. His mother and father still live there, and he's been living for some years now at Arlington, Virginia. Here's Colonel Powers again.
From the USS NOAA, that astronaut John Glenn has, in fact, come out of the Friendship 7 spacecraft. They are in voice communication and working together to make the arrangements for him to get out of the spacecraft. This is Mercury Control.
Colonel Powers said just then that we are still waiting to hear that Colonel Glenn has emerged from the spacecraft. There is voice communication between the personnel on board the deck of the destroyer NOAA and the astronaut who remains temporarily inside the spacecraft. And there is a certain amount of technical work that has to be done before he can be brought out. In an emergency, Colonel Glenn could have cut himself loose. He had a pair of surgical shears in one of the pockets of his spacesuit, and he could have done it in a hurry, but there's no need for that now. And so all concerned are willing to take their time.
It still shows once again the tremendous discipline and nerves of steel that John Glenn and his six fellow astronauts have. The average man, after going through an ordeal, which indeed it was, really, in that cramped position for 8 hours, would just want to get out as fast as he could, any which way. And Glenn is still following the procedures that he's been taught so thoroughly during almost 3 years' time now.
The ordinary man, probably at this point, if he were still able to talk coherently, would be saying, "Let me out of here.
Yeah, let me out."
But Colonel Glenn, performing like a military test pilot, which he is still just as calm, unconcerned, unruffled, and in full control of himself as ever.
Dallas, do you have any idea what's going to happen to his spacecraft? It's a rather famous item now, very much like Lindbergh's Spirit of St. Louis.
No, I don't.
Are they looking for the Smithsonian or what?
The Shepard spacecraft was taken to the Smithsonian, And it's quite possible that the same thing will happen to this, but no, we haven't heard any official word yet on what will happen. Now, we have established contact with the Glenn home in Arlington, Virginia, so we will switch now to Arlington. Dave Derry reporting.
This is Dave Derry at the home in Arlington, Virginia, and at the present time I'm standing about 15 feet from the front door in a mob of about 100 people, including a lot of photographers and newsmen, waiting for news of a possible reaction from inside the Glenn home. Ford Eastman, the NASA representative here who's been acting as go-between, is inside the house right now. There are several policemen at the front door to keep anyone who wants to get in, if they could get through the crowd, from getting in. A police lieutenant is just walking out now, and Ford Eastman is coming out. We'll try to switch up to the microphones we have set up on the front porch here, the small front porch, and see if we can pick up any comments that he has.
Are you happy with this setup now of the photographers over there and the voice and the reporters over here?
Pretty awkward statement.
Oh, just a minute. Let's see. I thought this was going to be cleared. So the photographers...
No, he's there. Charlie Powers is talking.
Ford Eastman is now talking to CBS News correspondent Nancy Hartman
up
there.
Are you guys happy now?
Who is trying to find out what is going on here.
What's that?
And everybody is being... pushed back a little bit, feeling somewhat like sardines in a can here in the front yard of the Glenn home. Apparently, he's not going to have a statement at this time. Just coming out to say that Mrs. Glenn may be out in a little while. This is the indication we get here at the Glenn home. Photographers taking pictures. And it appears now that we are going to have to wait a little while longer before Mrs. Glenn will have a statement. This is Dave Derry, CBS News, Glenn home in Arlington.
Well, it's quite understandable that Mrs. Glenn isn't able to come out right now. The chances are that she's having some difficulty controlling her emotions. While we were hearing that report from Dave Derry in Arlington, Colonel Powers came on again briefly and reported that the work is now underway of removing the instrument panel in front of Colonel Glenn's face, just above him now, and also a portion of the upper bulkhead. And when that is accomplished, then he will be able to emerge from the neck of the spacecraft. And Colonel Glenn is assisting in his own egress from the craft. The removal of the panel is necessary, as we said a while ago, in order to allow him to come out the upper neck of the capsule. Just why he's not coming out the side hatch is not known. Perhaps the hatch itself was a little bit damaged in the process of recovery. In any case, the word from the destroyer NOAA is that he is coming out the neck of the spacecraft and should be out shortly.
Dallas, I'd like to interrupt. A very distinguished and a very happy gentleman has just walked into our CBS radio mobile unit here, James McDonald, the man whose company built the spacecraft that carried John Glenn on his three-orbital trip today. Mr. McDonald, what are your reactions right now? I know you're happy, but what's overmost in your mind?
Well, I feel very much that our team of 21,000 people should be deeply grateful for this opportunity to have been a small part in this great American team that has put the first American astronaut into triple orbit around the Earth. I'm very deeply impressed. We're part of a great team which under NASA's leadership, General Dynamics Astronautics provided the Atlas booster that just performed magnificently. The specialists in radio and telemetering supplied that worldwide network that was just so terrific. To be able to talk to Glenn around the world through these various stations and get his comments and give him instructions was a tremendously important part of it. And what I would like to tell my 21,000 teammates in St. Louis when I go to Hangar S to report to them in a moment is to impress on them how we're part of a great team. And in this great team, aside from our company and General Dynamics and about over 4,000 supporting companies, and the Air Force and the Navy. Last but not least is this great astronaut, John Glenn. He is terrific. He is just terrific.
Mr. McDonald, let me interrupt for just a moment. We have word now that because of difficulties in clearing the way for Colonel Glenn to emerge from the neck of the spacecraft, the personnel on board the destroyer NOAA have decided to blow the side hatch so that he will be able to come out that way.
That is routine procedure. That is the way it's designed. It's just like the escape mechanism from our supersonic jet fighters, in which the big canopy above them, for purposes of egress, can be blown off in the same way this hatch can be blown off. Perfectly easy, perfectly routine.
Well, Mr. McDonald, what would have been the preferred method? We were under the impression that he would come out the side hatch anyway. Now it appears that he's coming out the side hatch, but originally he was coming out the neck.
Well, the capsule is designed so that the astronaut can get out in either way, and heretofore the astronauts have, without exception, preferred to come out the side. But they can come out the neck if they desire to.
Mr. McDonald, I certainly don't mean to mar your great day, but could you tell us now, do you have any idea what might have caused that slight attitude systems problem?
The cause for that could have been any number of things, and I would like to approach it in a slightly different way. It proves the great desirability of having the intelligent astronaut in the machine instead of doing everything automatically. And it proves that in space that there's a real place for the intelligent human being.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. McDonald.
Oh, excuse me.
Go ahead. Thank you very much, Mr. McDonald. We now have a report from Colonel Powers that Colonel Glenn has emerged from the spacecraft, and he's on the deck of the destroyer NOAA, and he's reported hale and hearty. Well, while we were listening to Mr. James McDonald of the McDonald Aircraft Corporation, we did get that word that John Glenn has emerged. Presumably the technicians on board the deck of the destroyer NOAA blew the side hatch, and while we were talking to Mr. James McDonald, astronaut Glenn freed himself from the straps which held him in place on the foam rubber couch inside the capsule, and he has now come out on the deck of the NOAA reporting himself hale and hearty. So, for all practical purposes, the great flight is over. Now will come the transfer to the carrier, Randolph, and after that, a flight to Grand Turk Island in the Lower Bahamas, and the beginning of the debriefing process. We've been told earlier that very few people are allowed to talk to Glenn. In fact, the sailors, the crew members involved in personal contact with him in the moments when he came out of the capsule, were allowed only to indulge in just a very few questions. For example, how do you feel? Do you need anything right now? And so forth. The detailed questioning will come from flight surgeons intimately connected with the Mercury operation. Well, now, we're going to get some reaction from outside of Cape Canaveral, and we'll switch now from our CBS News headquarters here to New York. Stuart Novins reporting.
The streets of New York City, Dallas, have been extraordinarily empty today as the inhabitants of this city, which likes to think of itself as cynical and sophisticated, have been glued to their radio and television sets. Just a few minutes ago, as you gave us the voice of Shorty Powers announcing that the capsule was on the deck of the NOAA and that Glenn was in excellent condition, the tall office buildings that huddled together here in mid-Manhattan practically burst into snowfalls of ticker tape and shredded paper. The window offices all around us are open. The people inside, who obviously haven't been doing very much work today, standing there applauding and throwing anything that won't bounce out of the windows. Thousands of people have been standing in Grand Central Station, where CBS News has been presenting the minute-by-minute report of the launch, and there has been generally great applauding and cheering. Now back to Dallas Townsend.
Well, Chuck, that's rather well stew. I think we're getting a little punch drunk down here. But that indeed, Stu, is the situation here. And now we're going to switch again from Cape Canaveral
And for the remarks of President Kennedy, we take you to the White House.
And he was, as are the other astronauts, the kind of American of whom we are most proud. Some years ago, as a Marine pilot, he raced the sun across this country and lost. And today, he won. I also want to say a word for all those who participated with Colonel Glenn at Canaveral. They faced many disappointments and delays. The burdens upon them were great, but they kept their heads and they made a judgment, and I think their judgment's been vindicated. We have a long way to go in the space race. We started late, but this is the new ocean, and I believe the United States must sail on it and be in a position second to none. Some years, months ago, I said that I hoped that every American would serve his country. Today, Colonel Glenn served his, and we all express our thanks to him.
This is the new ocean. The United States must sail on it.
President Kennedy, speaking from the White House just now, in praise and congratulation to Colonel Glenn. And you may have noted that he also praised the judgment of the men in charge of the Mercury manned spaceflight program. It's a judgment which has been subject to considerable criticism in the past few months, but today, said President Kennedy, that judgment has been vindicated. And he also said, this is the new ocean. The United States started from behind, but this is the new ocean, and we must sail upon it. This is Dallas Townsend. We'll be back with our coverage of America's first orbital flight from Cape Canaveral in just a minute.
This is the CBS Radio Network.
This is KCBS and KCBS FM San Francisco.
It's here, a bread improvement you can actually see. New Wonder Soft Whipped Bread is made from a creamy, smooth mix, not a thick dough, so it has no holes, looks like cake. In fact, New Wonder Soft Whipped is such an improvement over conventional breads, you can see the difference at a glance. The holes are gone, the texture is terrific, and the taste is out of this world. The secret of New Wonder Soft Whipped Bread is a special process that makes bread like cake, from a mix that's whirled and spun and blended to a silky smoothness. The result is a marvelous, delicious new bread that has no holes, looks like cake. No holes means no jelly, jam, or catsup drips on tablecloths or children's clothes. And Wonder Soft Whipped Enriched Bread supplies vitamins, minerals, and proteins that help promote growth, stamina, and all-over vitality. So be sure you serve this new bread whirled from a creamy, smooth mix. The bread that's famous for helping build strong bodies 12 ways. New Wonder Soft Whipped Bread.
This is Dallas Townsend reporting again for CBS News from Cape Canaveral, Florida, where we are now cheering and applauding, as everyone else is in the United States, the successful completion of John Glenn's three-orbit flight around the Earth. And just a moment ago, President Kennedy added his words of congratulation from the White House, praising the achievement of Colonel Glenn, praising the judgment of the man in charge of the manned spaceflight program, the judgment which he said has today been vindicated. We're still waiting for further word from the destroyer NOAA, where John Glenn now is after having emerged from the capsule through the side hatch. We'll return in a moment to our coverage of this epic-making event. Right now, we're going to pause for a word from Rambler and Ed Herlihy.
Of all the innovations claimed by car makers this year, possibly the most important and the one car experts hail as the biggest news comes from Rambler. It is the new e-stick transmission, available on all Rambler Americans for 1962. With Rambler's e-stick transmission, there is no clutch pedal. You get what many car buyers have been requesting for years, most of the convenience of full automatic transmission for about one-third the usual cost, and with stick shift economy. The new e-stick transmission, available only on Rambler American and no other compact. Another of the 102 ways Rambler is new and better for 1962. Another reason why Rambler sales are at an all-time high. This weekend, your Rambler dealer is able to offer you a weekend special deal. It is a special money-saving opportunity to own a new 1962 Rambler.
Ask your Rambler dealer about his weekend special deal.
Now back to Dallas Townsend at Cape Canaveral.
Well, here we are on a beautiful, lovely, sunny, and cloudless afternoon at Cape Canaveral, and everybody's beginning to relax now that John Glenn has successfully orbited the Earth three times and has come back alive, well, and hearty. In the words of Colonel Powers, hail and hearty. We still have no further word from the destroyer NOAA, where Colonel Glenn is now located. We assume that he will soon be transferred from the NOAA to the deck of the carrier Randolph, which was directing the recovery forces in the third orbit recovery area. We've heard now from President Kennedy at the White House praising Colonel Glenn, congratulating him on his achievement. A couple of days from now, the chances are that Colonel Glenn will be able to receive congratulations from the President personally after he completes the debriefing process and has flown to Washington for a conference with news reporters and then a visit to the White House. And it's safe to say that the entire nation joins President Kennedy in adding its own congratulations to the achievement of Colonel Glenn, because it has been a great one and has been accomplished after what seemed like an agonizing series of delays. Of course, those delays were magnified, probably out of proportion, by the fact that every delay was announced publicly, that every postponement attracted nationwide attention. And there was a perfectly normal, understandable human reaction, a feeling of frustration and impatience that first one thing and then another prevented the launching from taking place. Today it did. After 10 postponements, it finally went. It finally began at 9:47 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. The flight went almost exactly as programmed. Colonel Glenn flew, from a point of view of Earth mileage, well over 75,000 miles. He splashed down in the Atlantic. He's been recovered by the destroyer NOAA, and the flight is over. So we can all relax. We can all feel happy that, at long last, this country has sent a man into orbit and has sent him around the world three times, brought him back safely. Still no word from the destroyer NOAA. Just a brief recapitulation. Colonel Glenn was launched aboard the Mercury spacecraft Friendship 7, a name which he himself gave to it. He was launched aboard an Atlas booster. The booster put him into orbit in the vicinity of Bermuda at an altitude of 100 miles. He hit the window in the sky, which the space people often talk about. He hit it exactly. He went into orbit at a perigee, a low point of 100 miles, traveling at 17,545 miles an hour. He reached a high point, an apogee, of 160 miles. He traveled eastward around the world, crossing the Atlantic Ocean, passing in the vicinity of Bermuda, the Canary Islands, the Cape Verde Islands, then across the continent of Africa, out over the Indian Ocean in the vicinity of Zanzibar, which is located just off the east coast of Africa, out over the Indian Ocean, where he passed by an Indian Ocean tracking ship. And at that point, the only experiment, as far as we know, that was expected did not take place. The flares, which the space agency had hoped would be fired in the expectation that Colonel Glenn would see them, those flares were not fired because the weather conditions over the Indian Ocean were not favorable. And then on he went over Australia, over the Pacific, and back to the United States. And now we're going to switch from our CBS News headquarters to Hangar S on Cape Canaveral to Dick Bate for a cake ceremony.
Here on the parking lot outside Hangar S, the astronaut's hangar, another Mercury capsule is displayed inside a roped-off area. This capsule, however, won't fly. It's made out of some 125 standard sheets of cake. It weighs about 900 pounds, but it looks just exactly like a Mercury astronaut capsule. It's the same size and the same shape. It even has the same lettering on the side. In this cake, there are some 300 pounds of sugar, 190 pounds of butter, 250 pounds of flour, and some 1,200 eggs, plus 100 quarts of milk, mixed fruit, powdered sugar, margarine, egg whites, and different kinds of flavoring. I would guess that there are now a couple hundred of the people who helped put John Glenn into orbit now gathered around waiting for the first piece of cake to be cut and for the celebration party to get started. This is Richard Bate at the Hangar S position, Cape Canaveral.
Well, it's taken those people who made that cake a long time to bring it out in the open, ready for delivery to Colonel Glenn. It's been in cold storage, or at least in the refrigerator, back at one of the motels on the Cape for about 4 weeks now. And finally, at last, they're going to be able to say that they baked the cake and John Glenn was here to cut it. Well, now, let's switch again from CBS News headquarters at Cape Canaveral back to Washington for reaction on Capitol Hill. So we'll switch to the Capitol, Wells Church, reporting.
Well, Dallas, here at the old Supreme Court chamber, I guess the scene was almost an exact duplicate of the many that you've described this afternoon. People listened, and then when the moment came that John Glenn was down safely, there was an uproar, a cheer. This staid old room really rocked for a few minutes with those cheers. Members of Congress, like everybody else, delighted. There was a good deal of nervousness here, as witness the fact that I think they consumed, I'm told, some 75 gallons of coffee during this stretch of time. That's a lot of coffee, even for members of Congress. It's now quiet here, as it is down there. So, this is CBS News, the United States Capitol.
Thank you very much, Ted Church, for that report from Washington. Yes, it is quiet here. At the moment, things are quieting down. An air of relaxation has set in, an air, I would say, also of almost unconquerable relief. Now that the great flight is at last going into the history books. A flight for which this country can take genuine pride, a flight which will certainly be measured somewhere alongside the Wright brothers' flight at Kitty Hawk in December 1903. And in fact, Colonel Glenn has compared this flight with what the Wright brothers did on the sand hills of North Carolina so many years ago. Not so many, really. Only 58 years to go from the first powered flight in this country, which lasted just a few hundred feet, to the time when an American citizen could fly around the world three times in 4.5 hours. A word now on Colonel Powers, the Project Mercury spokesman. He has left Mercury Control, and he is now on his way to the airstrip to fly to Grand Turk Island to be with John Glenn when he arrives there for the debriefing. That flight should take probably about an hour. So, unless something unusual happens, the chances are we'll be hearing no more from Colonel Powers this afternoon. A lot of people are gathering outside Mercury Control, a great deal of hustle and bustle. Chances are that most of the people involved in the operation, the people who sat in the Mercury Control Center during those long, extremely tense hours, are now coming out ready to call it a day and go home and relax for a while. The atmosphere in Mercury Control is an extremely businesslike one, extremely tense during the long hours of the flight, with the Mercury Operations Director, Walter Williams, seated about in the middle of a 50-square-foot room, watching a large number of consoles and panels as the flight progresses. Now we're going to switch to New Concord, Ohio, where a ceremony is in progress. We'll switch to New Concord.
When you feared that the flight would not be successful,
that's a hard question to answer, part of it. Feelings are something that you just cannot put into words. But answering the part about wondering about the flight, there never has been a moment since.
Let me explain briefly. This is Mrs. John H. Glenn, Sr., the mother of astronaut John Glenn, talking in New Concord, Ohio.
When he did take the flight, which was today. And right now, I'm so very, very thankful to God for his safety and for the success of the mission which went today.
Thank you. News Rep, CBS. Mrs. Glenn, I understand that at the moment the rocket actually lifted off the pad, neither you nor Mr. Glenn said anything whatever. What were you thinking at that exact moment?
Well, I think the most tense moment would be just after the launch and before the word came that an orbit had been attained, because that is a time of suspense. I know there are a lot of split-second things which must take place just in the right order. And, of course, that was the most tense moment. I don't remember just what I was thinking at the time.
Jim Hurlbut, NBC News. Mr. and Mrs. John Glenn, the name of your son has been in the prayers of a great many people for a long time, and the whole free world has been impressed with his frequent expressions of religious faith. Do you believe that those prayers and that religious faith played an important part in the success of today's flight? And do you believe this will be important in the future of the free world?
You answer that, then.
Well, we certainly do. We're a Christian family. And it thrills us to hear John give his testimony over there as to his Christian faith. And I think that today shows that prayer has been answered. We've had hundreds of letters from friends and people that we never knew or never expected to know that they were praying. And seemingly, I notice among the newsmen many times, our prayers will be with you, or something like that, in an interview. We appreciate that very much, and we have faith enough to believe that our prayer has been answered.
Thank you, sir. If nobody else is going to ask another question, I'd like to ask another question. Here we have one.
Associated Press, my name's Hall. Have you been invited to a White House press reception or reception of any kind?
No.
When do you expect to see John?
Well, we would like to see him just as soon after he comes home as possible.
You expect him home soon?
We haven't heard anything about that as yet.
Jack Burchill, now that your son has become the first to orbit the Earth, what would your feelings be if you were fixed to be the first to make an attempt at the moon?
Well, I think that's a long ways off yet myself. I think there's a lot to be done, and there's a lot more to be done in the orbital realm before we try to go to the moon. But I wouldn't be a bit surprised when it comes time to go that he'll want to make the first trip.
How have you managed to stand up under the barrage of attention, camera crews and reporters that have been living almost with you for the past 5 weeks or so?
Attention, barrage of reporters.
Oh, yeah, we've enjoyed that very much. We've certainly been a wonderful bunch of people, and The first few times that we met the press, I think the first time we went to the door and there was five men standing there, and they started to introduce themselves, you know. Well, I can't remember one name, let alone a dozen. I said, well, come on in. As far as I'm concerned, you're all Joneses.
So you miss all that excitement today?
Pardon me?
Did you miss all that excitement?
Will you miss excitement?
Oh, I expect we will, yes. We've enjoyed every minute of it. We've spent about 5 weeks every day, maybe four or five different people each day. And with one very humorous thing happened, I think the first bunch was there when we were very much excited and had never been in front of the camera before. And I started to make a voice recording picture. And all once a guy ran out and he says, cut! Well, I thought I'd broke the machine or something, you know. Pretty bad way. So the man had the sound effect out in the kitchen, He said, there's a noise in there. I'm getting a noise. Well, one of the guys looked over at me and said I was playing at that mic cord. Said I had my fingers on the mic cord and I was playing it. So they started to make another recording, and I just thought it'd be a good joke, so I took my finger and I just scratched about three times on the mic, and he says, there's that noise again.
That's confetti flying over New York.
Well, you've been listening to a news conference at New Concord, Ohio, with Mr. and Mrs. John Herschel Glenn, Sr., the mother and father of astronaut John Herschel Glenn, Jr. And you could probably detect the relief that was very, very evident in the voice of Mr. Glenn, especially as he relaxed now. He was able to make jokes, and he had a most appreciative audience. That news conference took place in the high school gymnasium at New Concord, Ohio, where a large crowd had gathered. This was a great day for New Concord. This has really put New Concord on the map in the way that astronaut John Glenn himself, simply by being picked for the flight, never could do. It was a great day for New Concord. It was a great day for the United States. It certainly was a great day in Arlington, Virginia, where the wife and children of astronaut Glenn have been waiting out the long period, the long hours during which John Glenn, husband and father, was in orbit around the Earth. Now we're going to switch directly to Arlington, Virginia. Dave Derry, Dave Derry reporting.
This is Dave Derry reporting from Arlington, Virginia, where a NASA representative said just a moment ago it would be at least one or two more minutes before Mrs. Glenn would come outside. Inside the house at this time are Mrs. Glenn's parents, Dr. and Mrs. H.W. Castor of New Concord, Ohio, family friend and pastor, the Reverend Frank Irwin of the Little Falls United Presbyterian Church, along with Colonel Miller and Mrs. Miller, the neighbors next door, and, of course, the astronaut's wife, Anne, and their 16-year-old son, David, and 14-year-old daughter, Lynn. We're standing on the front yard, just about 12, perhaps 15 feet from the front door, and we're surrounded here by many newsmen, photographers, and several sightseers, people who have driven by in automobiles, have gotten out, and it looks like now Mrs. Glenn is coming out the front door. Ford Eastman, the NASA representative, who has been acting as our go-between between the press and the Glenn family, is, yes, here is Mrs. Glenn. Mrs.
Here
Glenn is
comes.
Walking outside. She's now in front of the microphone, and there is Lynn, 14-year-old Lynn, 16-year-old David, and I can see inside the door a man who apparently is, I believe it's Mrs. Glenn's father. CBS News correspondent Nancy Honchman is standing up right next to Mrs. Glenn at this time, and in a moment when Mrs. Glenn begins to speak, we'll switch up there and we'll hear Mrs. Glenn. People are now running up, and the area is becoming quite crowded. Everybody is smiling up there, in particular Mrs. Glenn. A very pretty, slim woman with black hair, sparkling dark eyes, a great big broad smile on her face right now. And Lynn is has now moved in between Nancy Honchman and Mrs. Glenn. And photographers are pressing up, getting pictures now before the interview by the reporters begins, and any comments by Mrs. Glenn. David is standing next to his mother, and he also has a big grin on his mouth. Looks mighty happy, although they do look a little tired. Now, here is Mrs. Glenn.
Quiet! There are several things that we would like to say, but I would want everyone to know that this is the most wonderful day for my family, and we're so proud of their father, of the Mercury team, of everyone that's made this such a successful day.
Louder.
Thank you.
Mrs. Glenn.
Do you have any plans to see your husband in the going south, perhaps? Or will you wait until he comes back here?
Well, for the way we feel now, I think we'll wait until they bring him back or wherever they say we can go see him.
Have you Mrs. Glenn, have you had any chance to talk to him, or do you have any plans to talk to him?
There are no plans now.
Mrs. Glenn, your husband said his condition was excellent. How is yours?
I'm happy. I feel wonderful.
How about you, Lynn?
Same.
And David
Glenn? I feel just the same.
What do
you, David, you tracked this all the way through. Were you in contact, and did you have your dad located all the time?
Well, we had a chart and a stopwatch. That's what you know. All right. And just put the stopwatch and looked at the track being the time. I'll mark that along the track the capsule is going to follow. So we just followed it along like that.
And we had two gloves, too.
Well, Lynn, according to your calculations, did your father stay on course?
As far as we know, he did. And as far as it turned out, he did, too.
Mrs. Glenn, were you worried very much during the course of the flight?
Well, I think that I probably was some, yes. But then when you, there's that faith that that sort of makes things look like it's going to be fine. And it
Mrs.
did.
Mrs. Glenn, you say you had faith and you all prayed immediately after the recovery to demonstrate your belief in God's hand in this flight. Can you tell us anything about how you felt about that from the beginning?
Well, my faith now is the same that it's always been, and I don't believe there would be anything more that I would like to say now. No.
Lynn? Understand you were too excited to sit still today. I'm always too excited to sit still.
What are your plans for tonight?
None in particular, except I've got to catch up on homework.
Mrs. Glenn, do you plan to have any kind of a neighborhood celebration here this evening?
Yes, we do. There will be the Millers and the Browns next door, and my mother and my father.
That's...
Will it be your house?
Well, I'm not sure yet. I'm not sure.
Glenn, is there any indication when you'll see your husband?
No, no.
Mrs. Glenn.
Well, I think my, I would say the last 15 seconds would be the, that would, I would say.
Before liftoff or?
Yes.
Mrs. Glenn, Walter Cronkite is down here at the other end. I wonder if you could say a word to him. You can hear him through this little earphone piece.
Hi, Walter. How are you? Well, thank you very, very much, Walter.
He's talking now to Walter Cronkite, who's on Cape Canaveral.
Well, thank you.
Mrs. Glenn,
and
what
now
was your best moment? You've been asked
Lynn
about
Glenn.
Your worst moment.
Walter, would you like
to... I think my best moment was 5 minutes and 15 seconds after when we...
Well, that was a news conference at Arlington, Virginia, with Mrs. John Glenn, Jr. and her two children. As they celebrated this triumph of Lieutenant Colonel John Glenn, who has now orbited the world three times and is back on board the destroyer NOAA. And Bill Downs, reporting from the carrier Randolph, tells us that the medical debriefing, which we were talking about a while ago, will take place on the NOAA. So he will be there for a couple of hours. It will not take place, as we expected earlier, on board the Randolph. Well, as we said a minute ago, Colonel Powers, the Project Mercury spokesman, has left Cape Canaveral. He's now on his way to Grand Turk Island to take part in the extensive debriefing when Colonel Glenn arrives there later today. Here at Cape Canaveral, the shadows are beginning to lengthen.
It's still a beautiful, clear, sunny day, but the shadows are lengthening. It's getting on toward 4 o'clock in the afternoon here on the central coast of Florida. And it's been a long day, a day full of excitement, beginning at 9:47 a.m. Eastern Standard Time this morning, when the Atlas booster lifted off pad 14 and hurtled John Glenn into orbit around the Earth. And John Glenn went 3 orbits, traveling at a speed of 17,545 miles an hour at an altitude ranging from 100 to 160 miles above the Earth. Each orbit took approximately 89 minutes. There were 3 of them. He was in orbit about 4.5 hours. He was back on the Atlantic 4 hours and 50 minutes after leaving Cape Canaveral, undoubtedly the most eventful 4 hours and 50 minutes of his entire life. As he returned, the Mercury spacecraft successfully withstood temperatures up to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit on the blunt face, the heat shield, and Glenn was able to get through that experience without any difficulty. However, he did say as he came down, boy, that was a real fireball. So now he's on board the destroyer NOAA in the Atlantic. He will be going through the debriefing process, and then he'll be flown to an island for 48 hours of extensive debriefing for rest and relaxation. After that, back to Washington, no doubt, for a meeting with President Kennedy and a news conference. And President Kennedy emphasized in those words that we heard from him a few minutes ago that the judgment of the men in charge of the Mercury manned space flight program has been vindicated. Colonel Glenn is a hero, and the entire country is grateful. Well, for about 9 hours now, with a few pauses here and there, we've been covering this event from our CBS News mobile headquarters at Cape Canaveral, and we want to emphasize that the coverage is by no means over. About half an hour from now, the National Space Agency will hold a news conference here at the Cape, and we will be covering that. So we urge you not to go away, because about half an hour from now, we will be back to cover that news conference in full. And at 7:10 Eastern Time this evening, we'll be back also with a complete recap of today's events. So we urge you also to listen to that program. This has been CBS News at Cape Canaveral, where today we saw the start and heard the finish of this country's first manned orbital flight. Lieutenant Colonel John Glenn, United States Marine Corps, went 3 times around the world and has come back safely. CBS News will continue, as we say, in about half an hour from now with that NASA news conference, and later this evening with a special recap at 7:10 Eastern Time. This is Dallas Townsend at Cape Canaveral.
Man in Orbit, another important moment in history, brought to you by Rambler and your Rambler dealer, who invites you to take advantage of his weekend special deal on a new Rambler. This is the CBS Radio Network.
KCBS, KCBS FM, San Francisco.
Mom, I'm in love. She's a girl in the Mother's Cookie song.
Oh, dear. I always hoped that someday you and Emmy Lou would be together again.
But, Mom, I know you'll love this girl.
Can she do needlepoint like Emmy Lou?
I guess not. But that doesn't seem to matter anymore. Let me play her song for you, Mom.
Well, put it on the gramophone.
Okay. She's the one on the left.
Mother's, I like your others. The cookies in the passionate purple package.
No more, son. It's a dreadful song.
But you've always liked Mother's Cookies. They're fresh and they're delicious. You know that. You love Mother's Cookies.
Yes, but that song. Emmy Lou knows the Mikado.
But, Mom...
Son, let me put away the gramophone crank until this other girl is out of your system.
Gee,
think,
Mom...
Think of Emmy Lou. It would break her heart.
I can't help it. I like Emmy Lou a lot, Mom, but golly, she won't be up for parole until next year.
Like coconut, then try Mother's Delicious Snow Puffs at your grocer's now. Mother's Snow Puffs.
He made it, and a happy nation rejoices in the accomplishment. The Senate and a rebuff for the administration, the president and the government workers' pay, and a communist setback in the United Nations. This is Prescott Robinson in New York, sitting in for Douglas Edwards, reporting for the CBS Radio Network. Humanity today was as nearly united as humanity ever can be, as communists, Republicans, Democrats, pious and impious men, kept eyes on the screen, ears to the speaker, and prayed, whether they willed it or not,
that astronaut John Glenn would get successfully off the Earth and once up there would come successfully down again. That he did both these things, the world now knows. For the latest word on the miraculously fortunate feat, here is CBS News correspondent Charles Van Fremd, direct from Cape Canaveral.
What is there to say after a day without precedence in America's space achievements? Only that it was sensational, dramatic, with a happy ending. And though it was a very long time coming, it was very worth the wait. John Glenn is now on the destroyer NOAA, out in the Atlantic Ocean after a 4-hour and 50-minute rocket ride that carried him 3 times around the world. From his destroyer position, he will be moved to Grand Turk Island in the Bahamas, and there he will spend the next 48 hours relaxing and also going through what the space agency calls a debriefing, in which he will tell doctors, psychologists, people assigned to the Project Mercury program, just everything that he can think of, that he experienced during his 4-hour and 50-minute ride. Also, of course, he will get a good deal of rest and relaxation. After that, it's assumed that Glenn will fly to Washington, where he'll receive a hero's welcome, just as did the first American man in space, Alan Shepard. That would include a meeting at the White House with the president and probably a news conference. Scientists, of course, will start evaluating all the data they got from miles and miles of telemetry right away. And as Walter Williams, the project officer for Project Mercury, has said before, this flight was just the end of the beginning. It was the first American orbital flight, but by no means the last. The next one on the schedule should come about 60 days from now, when astronaut Deke Slayton will try and match Glenn's historic ride. Sitting right here now in the CBS mobile unit, looking out across the way towards Pad 14, it's rather hard to believe that it was just at 9:47 this morning that Glenn made his ride. In the intervening hours, we've been bombarded with all sorts of material from Project Mercury spokesman John Shorty Powers, and there'll be a news conference to follow in just about 30 minutes' time. CBS News will carry that news conference from the Cape in about 30 minutes' time. That's the story for now, though. This is CBS News, Cape Canaveral.
In other news today, tradition-minded United States senators don't like to be pushed, and today a hurry-up procedure to force a showdown on President Kennedy's plan for a Department of Urban Affairs didn't sit too well. By a surprising margin of 15 votes, the Senate rejected a motion to force an early vote to create the Department of Urban Affairs. Had it been approved, it would have made certain that both houses of Congress went on record for or against the president's plan. President Kennedy today asked the Congress for a pay increase for more than 1.5 million white-collar government workers to bring their salaries into line with private industries. The amount of money involved, $1 billion over the next 3 years. The president proposed reform of the federal pay system to provide for wage hikes ranging from 3.7% for clerical workers to 35% for top-bracket employees. The president said enactment of the reform plan was fundamental to the maintenance of a standard of excellence in the federal service. Elsewhere on Capitol Hill, Senator Kenneth Keating asked a Senate committee to expand its inquiry into rights of servicemen to include the question of segregation in the armed forces. He said that while the Pentagon insists that integration has been effected, Negroes were still being forced to use segregated facilities at certain southern bases. A rebuff for Cuba and the communist bloc today in the United Nations as the General Assembly rejected a last-ditch move to get U.N. action on Fidel Castro's charges of U.S. intervention. The vote came on a mild resolution introduced by Mongolia, which simply called for friendly relations among countries recognizing the right of self-determination. The U.S. delegate Francis Plimpton called it a trick and declared it would give undue dignity to the Cuban charges, which he called crude, defamatory, and false. Ambassador Adlai Stevenson missed the debate. A spokesman said he is confined to bed with influenza. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara returned to Washington today from his conference with the Pacific Command at Hawaii. McNamara said that U.S. military aid to South Vietnam is becoming more and more effective in the fight against communist guerrillas there, that he was delighted with the progress he noted since his last trip to Hawaii in January. He told newsmen that our training aids and our logistical assistance are becoming more and more effective. He reiterated President Kennedy's recent assurances that no U.S. troops are being put into combat in Vietnam. He did say, however, that technicians and advisors serving with the South Vietnam Army are under instruction to return fire for self-protection if fired upon. There have been recent reports of new weapons being used by the North Vietnamese communists against American planes and helicopters doing transport duty, but McNamara said these appear to be only rifles and small arms. Britain today said that unless NATO helps her correct her balance of payments deficit, she will be forced to reduce the number of British troops stationed on mainland Europe. In her annual white paper on defense, Britain said today that she will fulfill her obligations to NATO, but the proportion of her forces outside the Commonwealth depends on what NATO does to curb the outflow of British currency. And Britain's aviation ministry announced today that Britain, the United States, and West Germany will share equally all future costs of Britain's B-1127, a vertical takeoff fighter plane. The ministry said the three-power agreement is the first of its kind. The plane, designed in 1957, has been built in two research models, both of which have been flown, and four other experimental models now under construction. Pope John XXIII today opened a preparatory session for this year's Ecumenical Council and began the meeting by welcoming Poland's Stefan Cardinal Wyszynski, who got special permission to come to Rome at this time. The Pope made no mention of the church-state struggle in Poland, now under a communist regime. In Hamburg, search teams are still looking for victims of last weekend's storm, with the threat of typhus and cholera spurring them on. Over 200 bodies have been recovered so far, and officials say there may be almost as many more in the wreckage the storm left behind. Hamburg's 2 million residents have been warned to boil all their drinking water and not to eat meats and other perishables left in shops when the floodwaters rose. In labor news today, a federal grand jury at Kansas City, Missouri, has indicted six Teamster Union officials for alleged embezzlement of union funds. And the United Auto Workers today postponed its scheduled strike at five Alice Chalmers manufacturing plants across the nation. The union said that production will be continued at the plants on a day-to-day basis. And that's the story on labor. Now for our daily stock market report, direct from the New York Stock Exchange.
The approximate volume on the New York Stock Exchange at the close today was about 3,400,000 shares, as compared with 3,350,000 at the close yesterday. Among the most active stocks, two oil companies showed gains and one declined. Royal Dutch, 37.5, up 1/2. Standard Oil of New Jersey, 55.875, up 1/4.
Now from San Francisco, KCBS covers the Bay Area and the West. Two men died in a grinding head-on automobile crash on Nimitz Freeway at Oakland today. The victims were 23-year-old Jack Silva and Francisco Souza, both of Oakland. Governor Brown has named William Forbes of San Marino to a 16-year term on the University of California Board of Regents. Forbes, a Republican, succeeds Victor H. Hansen of La Cañada, whose term is expiring. More news in a moment.
A View from the Bridge. This is Arthur Miller's unconventional story of Kathy, torn between love and loyalty. Of Eddie, the uncle who raised her as a daughter and loved her as a woman. A View from the Bridge, a raw, rugged motion picture. A View from the Bridge, a bold and honest look at life and love, set against the teeming violence of the Brooklyn docks. A drama that will hit you with the stunning force of a pile driver. A View from the Bridge, starring Ralph Malone, one of the most electrifying performers ever to hit the motion picture screen. And introducing the star of Broadway's West Side Story, Cara Lawrence, in her motion picture debut. A View from the Bridge, hailed by critics as a stunner, a shocker, a great motion picture. Don't miss Arthur Miller's A View from the Bridge.
Opening at the Presidio Theater, San Francisco, tomorrow evening. Exclusive Northern California premiere. Here is the KCBS Regional Weather Service. Cloudy in the Bay Area with a chance of showers today and tomorrow. Cloudy with showers in Northern and Central California through Wednesday. Snow in the mountains. The expected high temperature in the Bay today, 54 to 59. Low tonight, 40 to 47. Westerly winds, 10 to 20 miles an hour. The current downtown San Francisco temperature is 58 degrees. You hear it clearly from KCBS News.
Now the fastest and only through jets to Miami on National Airlines. Fly one jet all the way, no change of jets. Call your travel agent or National Airlines Douglas 26180.
Good afternoon, this is Scott Beach.
And Fred Gerner.
And wow, what a day this has been, huh? Spectrum 74 here, and I usually give you a list of historical events for your calendar. Today, there is no historical event in the past that can possibly surpass and replace what John Glenn has represented for us today. So, just mark your calendar that this is the day, the 20th of February, when an American astronaut went into space for the first time in orbit, and the excitement is so great and so fantastic as to pass everything else. We'll note, by the way, that at 1:30, a special press conference will come on when I'm sure that we'll hear full details on the flight itself from NASA headquarters at Cape Canaveral at 1:30. Fred, what else we got going for us?
Well, we're going to have a Money's Worth feature during this next half hour with Bill Strawn of Diebold Safe Company and an interview with John Conte, who is currently in Guys and Dolls at the Sheraton Palace Garden Court. And we'll begin with these features in just a moment.
Why do they call them Speedy Marts? Because they're open from 7 to 11, 7 days a week. When you want something, you get it fast. They call them Speedy Marts because they are so speedy.
Here we are on Spectrum 74, now at 11 and a half minutes past the hour of 1 o'clock. And as I said, there's a special news conference coming up at 1:30. Meantime, though, you just check this, old buddy.
Now D has B. Now D has B. Now D has B. Now White King D has B for borax. And White King D with borax gives you fresher, sweeter washes. Cleaner, too. Because wonderful White King D gives you whiter washes without bleach than other detergents when you add bleach. And now, White King D with borax rinses out every trace of dirt to give you whiter whites, brighter brights than ever before. White King D with borax gets washes so sweet, so fresh, so extra clean. Remember, White King D now has borax. So make your next wash a whiter, fresher, sweeter wash. Use White King D with borax. Now D has B. Now D has B. Now D has B. Now D has B.
The other day on Spectrum 74, we were speaking with Mr. Bill Strawn on Your Money's Worth. He is branch manager of Diebold Incorporated, manufacturers of record safes and cash safes. And we asked him to come back again today. We talked about home safes. Let's talk about office safes today. The individual who is going into business and is thinking about a safe, what should he take, Mr. Strawn, into consideration?
First, he should realize that the insurance companies, while they write fine policies these days with all kinds of coverage, they cannot and will not accept ashes as proof of loss.